Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm not an engineer or even a techie. If anything, I incline more toward the low-tech than the high-tech. And do not devote time to reading up on the latest advances in technology of any sort. That being said, I'm thankful for the opportunity this talk provided for doing research on at least a few of the ways that drones are being used for civilian and military purposes. And I will use some examples to illustrate moral issues we need to address tonight. But even these examples are likely to be outdated soon. It is literally true that every day there is a press release on a new technology that did not exist yesterday. And sadly, especially in Ukraine and in the Holy Land, each day experimental weapons are combat tested and the results reported to us in sometimes gruesome detail. So whatever I say today about drone technology will have to be qualified tomorrow. Yet whether or not new technologies, such as the Epirus Corporation's Leonidas, a software-defined solid-state, long-pulse, high-power microwave system counter-electronic device, will prove effective in protecting our troops from drone attacks, this will not change the moral issues posed by drone warfare. These moral principles that govern the right use of violence are unchanging and written not in algorithmic code, but on the human heart. Second, I will not be passing judgment on specific military operations involving drones. While the moral principles that we will be reviewing tonight, of course, must be brought to bear on concrete situations, moral theory is about universals, not particulars. Central to the virtue ethics approach to moral reasoning is the claim that the virtue of prudence requires understanding moral principles, but also intimate knowledge of the relevant particulars coupled with the moral character that aids, or at least does not inhibit, moral decision-making. Those who lack the sufficient degree of courage will prove in battle to be incapable of moral reasoning. For they will do such things as mistake women and children running into a building for enemy soldiers. Actually, one of the arguments for drone warfare is that it allows for soldiers on the ground to be aided by those removed from the distorting effects of violent threats. While moral principles can universally rule out certain uses of violence, such as intentional targeting of civilians, those without the relevant information can at best only conjecture as to whether specific actions were moral. A recent example is the U.S.'s January 3, 2020 drone attack in Iraq on Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. As an official in a government with which the United States was not at war, who was also reportedly the mastermind of terrorist attacks on U.S. soldiers, it is difficult to determine if and how just war principles apply. Adding to this the fact that civilians are not privy to key pieces of evidence, we are often left in such cases with hypotheticals. If this is the case, then this is how we would assess it. Yeah, no problem. Third, and much more briefly, this is not a discussion of international law. Our concern is not with what is legal or illegal in war, but with what is moral or immoral. Certainly, these two are related to one another. In the sense that international law can bind in conscience our actions, but I will largely be passing over such concerns. What I will be doing in this talk is explaining the moral principles that must be brought to bear on drone warfare. I will first provide an outline of the just war approach to analysis of war. After doing this, I will apply these principles to drone warfare. Time permitting, I will conclude with some considerations that are unique to the use of AI in drone warfare. And I hope you have the handout. I think there's some other copies around if you don't have one. Maybe if you want to raise their hand, and do we have more copies somewhere? Okay, yeah, right there, great, okay. Okay, so section one. Won't be some quotes for a little while here, but we'll get to them. Just war theory, peace is the end and is twofold. Our time tonight does not allow for a consideration of alternative approaches to war, such as holy war, doing the will of God, or Machiavellian realism, the ends justify the means. But I would be happy to discuss problems with those approaches in the Q&A. Suffice it to say that we are in the fortunate position of a broad agreement between religious and secular people, and between most people across the political spectrum, that some war form of just war theory should govern the state's use of violence against enemies to its people. So we're going to jump right into Aquinas as an important source of just war thinking, and then look at contemporary development of it. It's an odd thing to discover that Aquinas' treatment of just war theory is found in his treatise on love, or charity. And we can understand why this is so when we grasp this fundamental point that we must look to the end always. If war is ever to be justified, it must be based on its being directed to the proper end, and by the use of means appropriate to this end. Let's start our discussion by pointing to the end or goal of war. And on this first point, I encourage you to listen to Father Cajetan Cuddy's TI talk on the podcast. And there's four or five different talks on the Thomistic Institute podcast, all of which I'd recommend. And I think our talk tonight would supplement those. So quote A there, "Peace is the work of justice indirectly, insofar as justice removes the obstacles to peace. But it is the work of charity directly, since charity, according to its very nature, causes peace. For love is a unitive force, and peace is the union of the appetites, inclinations." We always need to focus on the end in life as a whole, and specifically in our discussion of just war. Peace is the result of charity. It is the rest we achieve when we are united to God, united within ourselves, and united to our neighbors as ourselves. It is this harmony, being in tune with God and His creation. While violence may at times be necessary to achieve this, the means to the end of peace must be compatible with love of God and neighbor as self. In a qualified or analogous way, we can call the unity among persons who share the same appetites or desires, even if they themselves are not in union with God and their souls are not united, as peace, and recognize it as the direct work of justice. If you look at B, you'll notice Aquinas calls it concord. Since we use the term peace in common society, when we talk about the peace of the nation or peace between nations, we'll use that term. But we want to bear in mind that peace in the full sense of the word requires virtue, requires grace, requires our being rightly ordered toward God and toward neighbor as self. But as Aquinas puts it in C, we can still speak among even those who seek violence of a kind of peace. Even those who seek war and dissension desire nothing but peace, which they deem themselves not to have. For as we stated above, there is no peace when a man concords with another man counter to what he would prefer. Consequently, men seek by means of war to break this concord, because it is a defective peace, in order that they may obtain peace where nothing is contrary to their will. Hence, all wars are waged that men may find a more perfect peace than that which they had heretofore. Aquinas reminds us here again that even among the wicked and violent, there is a desire for peace. The just war theory that is our focus this evening is rooted in this recognition of the goal of human life, the peace of the beatific vision, and that those who go to war unjustly are thereby making themselves miserable, and we should pity and not hate them. In justice and in charity, we will their good by seeking to illuminate the truth, if necessary, using violence. While Aquinas is not the source of the just war tradition, and this is an important note, that this tradition comes from the Greco-Roman philosophical tradition, and so it's not a distinctly Christian approach. It's one that reflection on reason and nature can reveal to us. And yet, Christians add some important components to this, and Aquinas, building on Augustine, stands out for the clarity that he brings to it. The two contributions of Aquinas I want to highlight are first, clearly articulating the essence of just war, and then its characteristics or qualities, especially the distinction between what today is called ius ad bellum, what is right when it comes to declaring war, or what is necessary or just, and ius in bello, when we are fighting in a war, what is right as distinct from wrong, just as distinct from unjust, etc. So here's the famous passage with the three essential criteria of ius ad bellum. I'm not going to read it, but basically first it needs to be declared by proper authority, a just cause is required, which is second, and then third, we need to have a right will for the end of peace, rightful intention. Aquinas doesn't really develop the jus in bello, what is right in war, but he does reflect on a few things. So, for example, that clerics cannot fight in war, and that's something that we recognize today, that someone who's wearing a military uniform but who is a chaplain cannot be targeted in an attack. That military actions cannot take place on holy days unless they are necessary for defense. And then third one here, that either, I'm not going to read that quote, it's a very long one here, that there are, while ambushes of certain sorts and deception or withholding information may be appropriate, there are limits to what we are allowed to do in withholding or in terms of truth-telling towards enemies. The second contribution of Aquinas is placing just war theory in the virtue ethics tradition, most importantly with the emphasis on prudence. As I mentioned when telling you that what I'm not going to do tonight, this approach allows us to distinguish between the necessary theoretical conditions of a just war and the prudential question of whether here and now we ought to go to war, and if so, how to fight it. While he does not develop such criteria that are now standard, his analysis of the virtues and the prudential considerations laid the foundation. In addition, we could add to Aquinas' right to go to war criteria points that he himself raises when thinking about rebellion and revolution. Last resort, we need to exhaust all other possible means, and reasonable prospect of success in the war and securing peace after the war. In order to address drone warfare, we need to outline the jus in bello principles, what is right in war, developed by the tradition after Aquinas. I should also add there's a whole host of disagreements in this contemporary development that I'm just going to have to sidestep, but that perhaps could come up in discussion. Okay, so the list of what is right in war varies in different accounts, but there is main agreement on these two I'm going to talk about. And I do need to warn you, though, as we go over them, that you need to be a good Thomist to follow along. And remember the adage, when in doubt, make a distinction. There's distinctions along the way for these two, and I'll try to keep it as simple as possible. So discrimination, proportionality. Those are the two principles. Discrimination. Only combatants can be targeted, which by extension generally forbids attacks on the enemy's civilian resources. And by the way, Sherman's March to the Sea is often actually used, at least in the Catholic Encyclopedia, as an example of a violation of this principle because he targeted civilian properties. I will try to make, just to mention that as an example that's often used. Let us also note that the term discrimination is often used in reference to drones, given how precise the targeting is in comparison to conventional weaponry. So a Hellfire missile is distinct from a Tomahawk. While this can be an argument in their favor, this is not in itself a moral evaluation. Let us try to use the terms specificity, precision, or physical discrimination when speaking about this aspect of weaponry. So a rifle is more specific, precise, or physically discriminate than a shotgun. And this can aid the soldier in achieving the objective of a morally discriminate attack on enemy combatants in civilian areas. Second, proportionality. The violence used must be proportionate to the violence inflicted or threatened, both in the sense that an unnecessary use of violence is incompatible with the intention of peace, and in the sense that the anticipated harm to non-combatants and civilian resources must be the least possible to achieve peace. The first sense of proportionality would prevent maiming, psychologically damaging, or killing combatants unnecessarily. While I think reasonable people can disagree about this, an example would be landmines. The 1997 Ottawa Treaty forbids them, but the U.S. is not a signatory. Another example would be chemical warfare, which was outlawed by the 1925 Geneva Protocol and augmented by the 1997 Chemical Weapons Convention. And the U.S. has signed off on this. Remember this example because it will become relevant to drone warfare as it is being used in the war in Ukraine today. The second sense of proportionality, that the anticipated harm to non-combatants and civilians must be the least possible for achieving peace, or the least necessary, requires introducing, one more principle, double effect. In brief, while one can never intentionally kill the innocent, one can inflict violence when the side effect of harm or death to non-combatants can be foreseen if and only if one intends a good moral object, does not intend the side effect. The side effect is not a means to the intended effect, and one has a proportionally grave reason for permitting the side effect. This principle of double effect is used in a wide variety of cases, such as in ectopic pregnancy, where the removal of a mother's fallopian tube results in the death of the baby, but is not generally considered an abortion since the unborn baby is not intentionally killed. In war, a stock example is whether we can blow up a bridge to prevent the enemy from besieging a town or our military forces if a child happens to wander onto the bridge. If you want to explore the nuanced issues at work here, I highly recommend Stephen Jensen's Good and Evil Actions, A Journey Through St. Thomas Aquinas. It gets more and more complicated the deeper you go. But let's look now at drone warfare, thinking about discrimination, proportionality. So that's section two in the handout. While I did not initially intend to follow a single resource for this talk, I recently stumbled across Joseph Chapa's 2022 book, Is Remote Warfare Moral? Weighing Issues of Life and Death from 7,000 Miles, and think outlining it would be a good way to structure our time together. Chapa served as a Predator pilot and has a PhD in philosophy from Oxford. So he brings together the rare combination of combat drone veteran and expert in just war theory. I also, I'll mention this later, that I found myself getting more convinced by his arguments as I went along here. I do want to mention, so his book is focused on Predators and Reapers, which are the two fighter jet size drone-controlled aircraft that the U.S. military uses. I guess the Predator was recently retired, but when he wrote the book in 2020 or so, I think it was still in use, and he was a pilot of one of them. Chapa begins with a particularly difficult example that we will return to in my critique of his book. As you probably know, the Predator is the aircraft that defined the genre of American drone warfare. The union of remotely piloted aircraft, a multispectral targeting system, and the Hellfire missile. The Predator was initially developed to hit mobile Scud missile systems in the Gulf War, in the 1991 Gulf War. But post 9/11, it has been central to the U.S. military's shift from targeting things to targeting people. In 2013, Chapa was called in as a safety observer on a Predator strike against a senior al-Qaeda commander in Afghanistan, who was standing outside his desert home. The special operations crew on the ground requested that the remote pilot, Dave Brown, who was with his crew 7,000 miles away in the U.S., immediately fire on the al-Qaeda commander, despite the fact that he was surrounded by his children. Brown conferred with his crew members, both of whom agreed that firing the missile was justified in light of the principles of discrimination and proportionality. Yet Brown took the initiative himself and told the ground crew that he would wait up to 5 minutes before firing in hopes that the children would re-enter the house. Thankfully, they did, and the al-Qaeda commander was killed without any loss of innocent life. Yet while Chapa himself does not pass judgment on this, the implication here is that the attack would have been justified either way, even if the children had died. Additionally, Chapa goes on to discuss a very similar attack in 2015 by a Reaper crew, and relates the terrible battle damage assessment that must be done, that now with the cameras being so precise and close, that after the attack, it's necessary to look very up close at the effects of the attack. I'm not going to read what happens in this specific instance that he has in mind, but it's terrible. Chapa tells such stories throughout his book to drive home that the push-button warfare stereotype of 18-year-old boy men high-fiving each other after scoring points in a real-world video game is false. The men and women who pilot these planes and serve in support of ground crews can exercise the same virtues of courage, justice, mercy, prudence, and the like as other combat soldiers. And the established protocols respect and foster the individual judgment of each crew member on the mission. The satisfaction they take in hitting their assigned target is not insensitivity to the humanity of others, but the satisfaction of a job well done in defense of the innocent. His book aims to explain what remote warfare is, how it relates to traditional warfare, and what moral principles we need to use in evaluating it. Here I'll provide a brief summary of the book before moving on to a critique. After an initial chapter on the development of the Predator that emphasizes the fact that despite its looks, it is just reliant as human on human inputs as is any other modern aircraft. Chapa addresses the claim that the warrior ethos cannot be formed in the riskless combat of the drone crew. His argument, which he expands upon in later chapters, is that the warrior ethos is not defined by the personal honor and glory of a duel, or even by the personal risk-taking that war usually entails, but by the practice of justice and mercy in the face of having to kill others. Before working out his account in more detail, he pauses to address the concern that drone warfare is immoral because of the psychological effects it has on the remote combat soldiers themselves. He provides studies that indicate a relatively low occurrence of PTSD in comparison to traditional combat veterans, though he does acknowledge that the challenge of being so geographically far from the violence and then going to the grocery store and going home, for example, and yet so ocularly near, so close in terms of seeing the effects of the violence, present particular challenges. I should add, of course, that there are studies that controvert the studies he provides and claim that the rate is significantly higher among drone operators. Further, Chapa acknowledges the possibility of moral injury, which we could just define as having violated your own conscience or having witnessed others doing so, being something that is more likely for the drone operator because of these decisions they have to make and think about so quickly afterwards because now they're in a peace situation. Those who hunt human targets and those who do the battle damage assessment are most prone to this. Returning to the moral issues, Chopper provides effective arguments against those who claim that drone warfare is inherently immoral because the remote combatants are not themselves at risk. As he rightly argues, the justification for violence in war is not self-defense, but the right of public authority to defend its own people in the name of the common good. The government's authorized combatants then justly inflict violence, not because they are personally at risk, and not even because their side is at risk, what we call structural risk, but because the enemy combatants pose a threat that must be stopped in the name of justice and peace. While this becomes less clear-cut when the non-combatants being protected are not our own citizens, or when those being attacked are non-state actors, members of terrorist organizations, for example, the principles of discrimination and proportionality can apply here as well. Next, Chapa adds a further defense of drone warfare that in some respects makes it more subject to what we could call moral control than traditional warfare is. Think, for example, of a Tomahawk cruise missile fired from a battleship, as distinct from a Hellcat missile fired from Predator or Reaper. If anything, the cruise missile is semi-autonomous in that a human cannot interfere post-launch, and the amount of time that passes in between launch and target is great. Pushed to its limits, the Tomahawk is fired from 1,000 miles away and hits its target 2 hours after launch, whereas the Hellfire's range is about 5 miles, and traveling at twice the speed of a Tomahawk, 1,000 miles per hour, hits its target in no more than 20 seconds. A point again about technology. Since he has written his book, Tomahawk upgrades in Block 4 and 5 allow for loitering, switching targets, and if I'm understanding this properly, even deactivation post-launch. So the new Tomahawk missiles are more like drone warfare than they were when he wrote the book. In addition, the instantaneous, dynamic, and ongoing communication between the sensor operator in the drone cockpit and the Joint Terminal Attack Controller, the JTAC, at the site of the target, coupled with the protocols that allow the cockpit crew to override the JTAC's request to fire, ensures human judgment about matters in life and death to be as close as possible to the violence. Introducing a third type of distance, so look at quote A there, Chapa calls this the judgment gap, the distance between the point of application of human judgment and the effects of that judgment. We will return to this at the end if we have time to discuss AI. But let me say now that Chapa is exactly right about how we should think about any technology-assisted violence. To what extent is its use traceable to and under the control of human judgment? In the case of the drone warfare applications he has in mind, the reduced judgment gap over conventional weaponry is an argument in their favor from the vantage point of just war analysis. That being said, let us recall the physical versus moral discrimination distinction. While the drone attack and the projectiles fired may in these cases be more physically discriminate than traditional weaponry, their use can be morally indiscriminate given the possibility of immoral human judgment. Further, in the cases CHOPPA focuses on, namely the use of drones to target people rather than objects, a sniper's rifle is more physically discriminate than is a Hellfire missile. And this point's going to factor into my critique. But one final point from CHOPPA. Not only are drone warfare operations capable of meeting the use in Bailo criteria of discrimination and proportionality, but the remote soldiers themselves are capable of forming and exercising the virtues just as the traditional soldier can. And this is where CHOPPA directly references Aristotle and Aquinas, so we're certainly on friendly ground here. While he himself does not make this explicit, his analysis is that of Aristotle. The soldier's courage is a noble kind, but those who habituate themselves to it via training need to root it in a more fundamental commitment to doing the difficult good. This allows us to see that the physical act of standing firm in the face of possible bodily death can of course be an act of courage. But so too can the mental act of standing firm in the face of possible retribution for acting according to one's conscience. In this sense, the Reaper pilot Major Jordan showed courage when he reported the presence of a child in a Taliban training camp in Afghanistan and maintained his position to his superior despite disagreements from other intelligence officers. His refusal to fire saved a child's life. And for this, we can rightly call him a brave, loyal, and honorable soldier. The institutional culture of U.S. remote warfare encourages the freedom of each member to form his or her own judgment and act according to the dictates of conscience. And we can even see how their regular contact with civilians can aid them in staying rooted in the moral judgments that are passed on by communities that fostered their own growth. As I have made clear, I'm generally favorable to CHOPPA's defense of U.S. drone warfare, and I became more so as I read his book. I'm thankful to know that our military has a high-ranking officer weighing in on moral issues based on virtue ethics and the just war tradition. While my impression is that CHOPPA is not a Thomist in the strict sense of the term, he is working with the same vocabulary and theoretical foundation, and it's clear he does so as a committed Christian. In a recent interview, he even says, quote, "As a Christian, I tend to be fairly Aristotelian in my understanding of virtue and flourishing," end quote. If he's not a friend of the Thomistic Institute or even an approved speaker, let me encourage you to befriend him. And in the spirit of friendship, let us say with the proverb, "Iron sharpens iron and one man sharpens another," and proceed to a critique. After doing so, I'll extend his analysis to the short-range drone warfare that characterizes the war in Ukraine. My critique is focused on the strategic level use of drones as part of foreign policy. While CHOPPA does address this in his book, I don't think he does so sufficiently. The example he himself uses as the hook is helpful. Recall the 2013 Predator strike on Al-Qaeda commander that would have killed his children had it not been for the good fortune of them returning to their home. A few minutes difference. Again, CHOPPA does not himself say this, but the implication is that firing the missile knowing the children would be killed would have been just due to the principles of proportionality and discrimination. Again, we're not targeting children. There's a side effect we expect. It's the last resort and so forth. But still, I do not want to question whether this was the right decision at the time, for I've already acknowledged that the point of this talk is not to exercise judgment on specific circumstances that require knowledge I simply cannot have. How valuable was this commander? How certain were we that killing him would prevent successful attacks against U.S. soldiers or civilians? How likely was it the crew would have been able to track and kill him had they not decided on the 5-minute firing order? What I would question is the strategic decisions that led to this crew being given this mission. If war is policy by other means, the question is whether or not this is good policy. Even granting CHOPPA's point about reduced judgment gap and the tremendous physical discrimination of drone weaponry and crews, we must ask whether U.S. policy is firmly rooted in moral discrimination and proportionality. I want to introduce you to insights from a book that I highly recommend on just war thinking. Joseph Capizzi, who is the Dean of Theology at the Catholic University of America, his book, Politics, Justice, and War, Christian Governance and the Ethics of Warfare. While the book is an Augustinian and not a Thomistic approach, they are certainly compatible, and I would argue that Aquinas is the best interpreter and developer of Augustine's approach to politics and war. Capiz's approach to the moral evaluation of war is largely compatible with Chapa's, though he does provide pointed critiques of U.S. military policies. I'm going to skip that, but the invasion of Iraq is an example. Capizzi does not provide a sustained discussion of drone warfare, though it occasionally serves as an example to illustrate a point. When discussing double effect, he points out that intention is not merely a subjective reality, what's in my head. I can't punch you and intend to do something else, but refers also to the objective end of a specific action. As he states, a drone operator cannot withhold the intention of killing non-combatants while dropping a bomb on them. And that's quote B on your handout, 2B. A drone strike aimed at killing one member of a wedding party cannot be analyzed in terms of the operator's mental exercise that he intends only to kill that individual, even though he knows the entire wedding party will be obliterated. Further, he states that destroying a legitimate target embedded end and requiring the destruction of illegitimate targets is not discriminate. Well, based on these quotes, it may seem that Capizzi would reject Chapa's account of the predator strike that serves as the hook. I don't think that's necessary. Double effect analysis is difficult in specific circumstances, and it's certainly possible that Capizzi would accept that the situation he has in mind is not morally identical to the one Chapa participated in. The question would be whether or not Chapa's case regarded a legitimate target embedded in illegitimate targets, or whether instead his case allowed for intending to kill the legitimate target with the side effect of an unintended death. More to the point, Chapa is concerned that technology, such as that used in drone warfare, may distort the morality of the interventions we justify by seducing us into thinking technology alone solves or raises discrimination concerns. While I think Chapa addresses this when it comes to combat situations, I think Capizzi is right to raise policy concerns, and this is C. Drone warfare technology allows us to involve ourselves in, quote, rhetorically humanitarian enterprises, resulting in two connected troublesome consequences. Technology allows us to intervene without the risk of spilling our own blood, and thus permits more an open-ended intervention because the interventions cost fewer of our own lives. As precise as our weapons are in the physical or technological sense, the use of them involves exposing the attack nation's civilians to greater harms than those to which the intervening state exposes its own military. It's hard to see what might be morally honorable about such halfway commitments as these. Moral discrimination requires the peaceful intention of loving the vulnerable of other nations rather than preferring our own safety. If it is worth intervening, we must be willing to expose our military to the risk of war and not use technology to minimize the political cost of our servicemen and women's death at the expense of our enemies' civilians. Notice there are two critiques here. One concerns discrimination and proportionality. The second concerns the actions of political leaders. I'm not going to get into that second one, but I think it is really interesting and important concern he raises. But I focus on the first. Regarding discrimination and proportionality, I take it that Capizzi's response to Chapa's chosen example of the 2013 Predator attack, that only fortunately did not lead to the death of children, is that our military strategy, which is itself rooted in our foreign policy, regularly forces us into situations in which we must make fine distinctions as to whether or not we are intending to kill noncombatants or only accepting their death as a side effect, and as to whether this or that target is sufficiently vital to our objectives that the death of non-combatants can be justified. While these circumstances are surely commonplace in traditional warfare situations, the fact that they do not pose a threat to our own soldiers' lives makes it easier to tip the balance in our favor. The fallen human tendency to mask self-interest as justice must be guarded against. And drone warfare makes this even more difficult than the tactical situation of a commanding officer who knows that his own soldiers might die if he orders an attack, rather than innocent civilians to whom he has no relation. More broadly, we must ask the question as to whether or not these attacks targeting individuals would be more discriminate, even in just the physical sense, if we had soldiers on the ground. At least in the case that Chop himself uses, the answer seems to be yes. While he might respond by arguing that we simply could not have gotten soldiers close enough to the Al-Qaeda commander, this seems to be a result of the decision to move toward drone warfare that involves us in more and more situations like this one, and at the expense of putting resources into developing tactics and training soldiers for such campaigns. While as a civilian, I'm reluctant to make such arguments because I'm aware of my own fallen tendency to prefer my own life over that of others. That being said, Capizzi is correct in the abstract to argue that our foreign policy and military strategy must take seriously the moral claim that central to taking up the call to serve is protecting not just our own citizens, but those of enemy nations. As a brief response in Chapa's favor, it would be worth looking at how drones could be used to warn non-combatants about impending attacks. Just as we can either drop conventional bombs on combatant targets, as well as flyers, warning or offering aids to non-combatants, so too can we include in our policy the requirement to use the best drone technology available to us as part of tactical operations. While this does not fully address the issue of risking non-combatant lives to protect our own soldiers, it would certainly help ensure that the lives of the innocent are part of the moral equation. Let me wrap up this moral analysis of drone warfare by extending his insights, Chapa's insights, to the short-range handheld drones being developed in the Ukrainian war, the type that you yourself could go buy in a store. What's been interesting in this technological development is that, at least in the Ukrainian military's use of handheld drones, is that we are witnessing a shift to the pre-9/11 strategy of targeting things rather than people. When a $2,000 drone, with a bomb strapped to it, and two soldiers can, with almost no risk to their safety from 2 miles away, destroy a multi-million dollar tank, we are surely witnessing the beginning of a new way of thinking about how to allocate military spending. I'm not suggesting that tanks, fighter jets, or naval ships will become obsolete, but that we will see more and more instances of technology fighting technology, not to mention cyber attacks and the like. As I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, anti-drone technology such as the Leonidas is now central to military spending and strategy. Yet none of this affects the morality of war. If anything, the short-range drone warfare is used to attack objects raises fewer moral concerns than does that of Predator and Reaper drones. At least one exception to this is the use of thermite on drones dropped over enemy trenches. Reports of so-called dragon drones being used by both Ukrainian and Russian militaries have raised moral concerns. Thermite burns at 4,000 plus degrees Fahrenheit and has been used in explosives since World War I. What seems to be new here is the use of thermite dropped from low-flying drones in order to burn up tree lines used by enemy soldiers and also, at least purportedly, to kill, maim, or psychologically damage the soldiers themselves. What is interesting is that discrimination is not the concern. It's only soldiers being targeted, but proportionality. What are the moral limits to what we can inflict on enemy soldiers? I mentioned earlier that some nations have signed off on treaties banning the use of landmines as well as chemical weapons. The U.S. has signed off on the latter, but not on the former. In addition, there's the 1980 UN Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, Protocol 3, which regulates the use of incendiary weapons such as thermite. For the record, the U.S. has signed off on this, as have Russia and Ukraine. Yet the protocol does not forbid the use of incendiaries, but rather demands that they only be used on military targets. As I understand it, the law simply points us back to the moral issue of proportionality and the prudential judgment as to whether any specific attack is on a military target, is necessary for peace, inflicts unnecessary suffering, etc. Okay, concluding remarks. I want to wrap up by at least pointing you in a helpful direction for thinking about how AI might affect our assessment of drone warfare. Perhaps you can anticipate the general response I would give based upon the analysis provided so far. The main point is that human judgment must be brought to bear as much as possible on the use of violence. We cannot outsource moral thinking to an algorithm or even to ethicists guiding coding engineers and computer scientists in the development of AI technologies. Every use of violence must be subject to prudential analysis and moral virtue, And AI is only acceptable to the extent that it aids rather than supplants this. I would encourage you to read the recent Vatican document, Antiqua et Nova, as a helpful guide in thinking through this. The difference between human intelligence and so-called artificial intelligence and the uniqueness of human judgment. And it provides a section on AI and warfare that's worth your time. Finally, let me just conclude by reminding us of the points we raised regarding Aquinas' treatment of war, the last quote on your handout. Justice is a habit whereby a man renders to each one his due by a constant and perpetual will. We must always remember that the only legitimate use of violence is one in which we, tragically, find it necessary to use it for the good of those we protect as well as for those we attack. We are seeking their good, not ours, when we attack them justly. And that's in part why we must risk our lives. Further, Aquinas situating his discussion of war in his treatise on charity reminds us that it is our love for the vulnerable as well as the love for our enemies that must prevail. God is love, and we cannot be in his care unless we love even those who seek to do us harm, praying for them even when we must act as killer angels protecting meek lambs. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.